This mortal coil.
You're on ABC Radio across Australia. Melanie Tate with you tonight, filling in for Sarah McDonald. And on this mortal coil, we try to dig down under the surface of people's lives and find some meaning in their life journey. I think I can safely say we're all looking for meaning and ultimately that elusive quicksilver element, happiness. But what if I was to say to you, all the looking, all the seeking, the grasping for it will not actually make us happy? Surely that doesn't make sense. How can we possibly get something we don't strive for? Well, my guest tonight might have a few answers for you. Genkel Sang Dorning is a Buddhist monk and a resident teacher at the Kadampa Meditation Centre in Melbourne, and he joins us tonight. Welcome, Dorning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Melanie. It's great to be with you.
Now, you have got this really incredible journey from banker to Buddhist monk, and I wonder if we could go way, way back first. 1976, Gatwick. Tell us a little bit about growing up in London, if you would.
Do you know what? It's just a fairly ordinary story, really, of going to school and trying to work out a pathway through life. Mm-hmm. I think by the time I got to secondary school and they put on these careers lessons in which you're trying to work out your own destiny and what you'd like to do with your life, I remember just thinking to myself, well, I want to be happy. Therefore, all I really want is a job that pays the most money. Mm-hmm. I didn't really have any vocation or any special interest. I thought, yeah, just if I get rich, then I'll be happy.
So I'm guessing that at the careers fair, there wasn't a Buddhist monk sitting there dispensing advice on how to be a Buddhist monk.
No, my hometown was definitely low on the ground in Buddhist monks, and so there wasn't many that you could actually turn. There was none actually. There was no Buddhist monks you could turn to, and I, to be honest, I always felt the careers teacher in those sessions was not that particularly interested either. Mm-hmm. I mean, I reckon it was tough for all. I mean, I grew up in a working class town, working class family, and I think it was tough for everybody trying to find their way. But in the end, at the time, the IT world was just about to boom, and mm-hmm. That seemed to be where you could make the most money. And eventually, I got involved in electronics and telecommunications, and I wasn't quite a banker, but I was a telecommunications engineer. Eventually in the banking industry, enabling trading floors to connect with other trading floors. And actually, that had a huge impact mm-hmm. on why I became a Buddhist monk, really.
It's a huge change in, I would imagine, the day-to-day life as well. But I just want to ask one other thing about your childhood. Did you ever have any inkling of spirituality or any kind of attraction towards the spiritual side of life as a young person?
Well, my next door neighbour was an elderly lady called Doris. And every Sunday, Doris would go to church. And I remember watching her leave every Sunday and thinking, I wonder what church is like. And so one day I asked my parents if I could go with her. And I was quite a naughty boy as a kid, but also very questioning and very much trying to find out what life was about. So for my parents, it was a really unusual thing that mm-hmm. their son was asking to go to church. But I wanted to know where she went. So for a period of time, I went to church with Doris.
Wow. And what did you, I mean, you must have got something out of it to go back with her more than once. What was it that you got out of it?
The tea was amazing.
Church tea and cakes are pretty good.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever had a cup of tea as good as it was in that church. And as you know, English people are powered by tea.
Yeah.
I found the teachings to be good, but not very solution orientated. That mm-hmm. was my personal view, and I'm being very careful because, obviously, you've probably got Christian listeners, and I wouldn't want to criticize. But I found that there was, for me, I needed more instruction on how not to sin.
Right.
Rather than be told not to.
Mm-hmm.
And also, my uncle is a Christian minister, and we've always felt that we've had a lot in common and that we're both seekers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say I was completely without a spiritual side, but I didn't last very long. And then I soon went back to just trying to find the meaning of life and going around the adventure playground with all my mates.
And in the pursuit of money, like you were saying before, would that be correct in saying
that
you thought money was?
Of course.
Yeah.
As I grew up, I thought, right, which job is going to pay the most money? And like I say, I was on the brink of the IT boom, and I became trained in electronics and telecommunications.
So does that mean then that you've got a real attraction to the scientific and the rational as well as the spiritual side to you?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that's really why Buddhism appealed to me so much. Just to sort of complete the story, I don't know if you remember, in 1999, we all thought the world would end.
Yep.
Because we didn't think the clocks would tick over.
Yeah.
And so I got paid quite a big bonus to be on call that night. And of course, the next day, interestingly enough, the world didn't end. And when that bonus came through, I decided that this wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to find more meaning. And funnily enough, I bought this one-way ticket to Australia with a six-month stop-off in Asia, hoping that on this journey I would find the meaning of life. And yeah, I had a great time, and I loved being in Australia. But after about a year, I realized that all that actually changed was the weather.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to pick up my career in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And before long, I thought, you know, I haven't found what it is that I set out to find. And as luck would have it, there was a Kadampa Buddhist temple right near where I was living at the time. And I eventually decided, well, I've changed everything else. I've traveled the world. I've explored career, relationships. So maybe I'll just see what meditation has to offer. And this idea of searching for something scientific or rational, this really came to the fore, because when I went to this class, the instructions were so clear and logical, I could see how I was creating my own problems and how I could create my own happiness by changing the way that I think. And even changing the way that I think is a logical process. And so I was greatly inspired by these instructions.
If you've just tuned in, we're hearing the story of Gen Kelsang Dorning. He is a Buddhist monk. He's from the Kadampa Meditation Centre in Melbourne, where he is a resident teacher there. And we're talking about that journey from, I guess, from layperson to monk and how that eventuated for Dorning. Can I just flip back one second, though? What was it about this part of the world, about Australia and South Asia, that appealed to you in this quest for the meaning of life? Like, why did you head this way instead of India or instead of Africa, for example?
There's two principal reasons for that. One is, as a kid, I used to listen to Asian music, and it used to conjure up images of magic and like an extraordinary world that you could live in as a child. You know, I thought the Far East was a magical land with this offer of promise. And I knew from watching Neighbours that the sun shines in Australia.
That's pretty appealing.
So those, if you've ever spent a lot of time in the UK, sometimes, again, as a kid, I used to think the actual colour of the sky was grey, was dark grey, because the cloud cover is so thick.
Yeah.
So really, these two things made me think, right, that's it. I'm going to that side of the world to find magic and sunshine. And as a result, I will be happy forever. Of course, I wasn't.
Wow. So you get to the Kadampa Meditation Centre in Sydney, and you're saying that the messages that you got were loud and clear and simple. What were those things that you learnt that made so much sense to you from the get-go?
Right. So I'm working in a merchant bank on George Street in Sydney, And from the window of my floor in the office, I can see the twinkling of the light reflecting off the harbour.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking how wonderful it would be to be outside, and then feeling unhappy and a bit miserable that I'm stuck in the office. And I always felt the problem was the office, or the problem was my mm-hmm. job, and the problem was this. And my very first teaching at Kanampa Meditation Centre Sydney was that what problems are bad feelings, and that bad feelings come from attaching yourself to something other than the situation that you're in, or attaching yourself to something else. It's a state of discontent or dissatisfaction. And I thought about this deeply, and the very next morning, and I'm sure your Sydney listeners will know this very well, I used to walk to work through the Botanic Gardens, and I'm sure that's familiar for people. And the next morning, I just sat in the Botanic Gardens thinking, I don't want to go to work. And I closed my eyes and I decided to question why. And I realized it's because I was attached to going to the beach.
Right.
Right. Or staying in bed.
Yeah.
And once I realized that my problem was not work, was not my boss, was not my colleagues, but it was my attachment, I blamed my attachment for the way I felt. And would you believe it? It disappeared. It was like I'd seen the hoax that my mind was creating, and just by seeing it, controlled it. And I went to work and had a really, really good day. Subsequently to that, I considered whether the beach really had what I thought it had to offer. I mean, when you're attached to something, your mind is telling you that it's a source of lasting happiness. But my experience of going to the beach in summer really doesn't add up to the hoax or the deception that your mind is presenting you with. Like, if you go to the beach on a hot day, you're literally laying there hot.
Mm.
So then you go into the water for a while until you're bored of that, and then you go back to being hot. And then you need something else. We constantly need an upgrade. So the next thing might be, do you know what? I need a Golden Gay time.
Mm-hmm.
So you go off to the kiosk and get an ice cream, and then you eat the ice cream. And when the ice cream's finished, your mind is already looking for something else. So the actual experience is not what the mind tells you it's going to be. So as I started to see this, I realized that it was possible to counter my attachment. And as I countered my attachment, my mind became peaceful. And as my mind became peaceful, I became happy. And so there I was now in the office, experiencing much better quality of life.
Donnie, this is a pretty profound realization to have in the early days of a meditation practice. And you've now been practicing for a long time and have taught lots of students. How often do you see that happen to someone, that they get it so quickly?
I see it again and again and again. In fact, I was just catching the tram in Melbourne, literally just 2 days ago, and then I was basically staying in Brunswick East because I was flying out the next morning. So I was catching the tram to where I was staying, and there was a girl on the tram, and she came up to me on the tram, and she said, "I've just been to your class. I've been coming to your classes for about 2 months." She said, "Thank you. My life has completely changed. I have never been happier ever." That's 2 months of coming to classes. So, and this is a story we hear again and again and again. Now, I had that same experience. It's nothing to do with me. It's to do with the power of training your mind.
So how do you go then from, you know, you've got this life that you start to get satisfaction and happiness within through meditation in Sydney, as working in, you know, as the electronics or the electronic guy for a bank? You're on Sydney Harbour, you're in the sunshine, everything's great. And what makes you decide to become a monk?
Okay. I mean,
they're such polar opposites, aren't they? Well, it seems like that.
It does seem like that. I think a big turning point for me was my boss, actually. And so my boss at the time was very difficult, and there's a number of reasons for that. I think one reason was I was the youngest in the team, and mm-hmm. and so on, and a conflict of personality. And my boss was very, very difficult. And I asked my Buddhist teacher at the time for some advice on a practice that I could do. And surprisingly, my teacher said, you need to love him. And I thought that was the most ridiculous advice I'd ever had. You know, I was expecting him to say, you need to be more patient, or what have you. So, but anyway, I took it on as a Buddhist project. I said, okay, I'll try. First day of that, I completely failed miserably. I started to become a little bit more creative in my method of practicing. I think one thing I did was I imagined, or I mentally superimposed, my brother's face on my boss, because I love my brother. So I thought this will work. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But anyway, to cut a long story short, after about 6 weeks, this guy and I, we became friends. I mean, he was telling me jokes. He was telling me some of the difficulties he was having at home. And so my experience of this guy completely changed. We'd become friends. So I went back to the teacher and I said, I have to say thank you for your advice. I put it into practice. And you were right, he changed. And the teacher said, no, he didn't. And that had such a profound impact, because what really happened is my reality had changed, mm-hmm. because my mind had changed. And even to this day, I get goosebumps when I think about it. And it made me think, you know, I need to see how far this can go, because if I can change my reality so dramatically by making a few changes in my thinking within a short period of time, what's at the end of this path? Where did Buddha go? And so that's that, and a few, and a couple of other things, like I watched a play of the life story of Buddha that made me cry, mm-hmm. and these things came together, and I felt like, okay, I'd like to become ordained and follow in Buddha's footsteps with my whole heart. And so I became a monk in May 2004.
Donning, what is the journey to doing that? You know, I know that within the Kadampa Buddhists, there are a lot of, non-monk. There are a lot of teachers who aren't monks themselves, you know, within the tradition. How do you go from being a normal person to a teacher to a monk? What's the process?
Well, anybody can be. Buddha taught that anybody that has a positive imprint in their heart, a good heart, can become ordained. So there's no set sort of structure. Mm-hmm. for becoming ordained, but it is something that you'd normally discuss with your own teacher first, and you'd work out between you whether you felt that you could make these commitments, because they're big commitments, you know. You're giving up. Basically, if you control your attachment, then ordination is the most beautiful, disciplined and structured life you could have. I mean, I don't have to worry about what I'm going to wear. Mm-hmm. It's always going to be the maroon. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty clear on my haircut. Mm-hmm. I know what I'm doing every day. So it's an easy, simple life. But I've also got vows against doing what most people do for happiness.
And what are the things that you have to vow against as a monk?
Well, I mean, you can condense them mm-hmm. into pretty much abandoning you know, taking intoxicants, sexual mm-hmm. activity, engaging in meaningless activities, practicing contentment, giving up worldly pleasures. Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, you can condense it into those things. And actually, those things do cause us a lot of torment anyway. Mm. So if the mind is free from attachment, then it's a very, very beautiful life. But if it's not, it's a very, very hard life. And I would say it's only really been in the last 5 years I've really just enjoyed the simple life. I feel like I've took 10 years to get into it, and now it's really, really begun.
That was actually something I wanted to ask you, because you did spend a lot of time on this earth before becoming a monk, you know, without those restrictions. Do you miss those things? Do you miss booze? Do you miss a sexual life, etc.? Do they crop up?
Not at all, because I mean, look, there's a lot of ways of practicing. You know, you don't have to become a monk to practice Buddhism. It's the premise of the Buddhist path is that happiness depends upon inner peace. Being a monk gives you the structure and helps you to facilitate prioritizing the development of inner peace.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're able to develop that inner peace, then your life is so full. Like if you can just imagine having a mind that's as calm as a vast mill pond, and constant pleasant feelings arising from that sense of calm, you abide in a state where life is always enjoyable, regardless of what you're doing. And the ordained life, if you like, nudges you towards doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you have other things you can do to distract yourself and feel you're alive, then there's a temptation to think, I'm not sure I want to control my mind. I'm going to go and get drunk. And that is drink and drugs is a way that a lot of people try to find a way out of the unpleasant feelings they're experiencing. But in a way, if that's just delaying happiness. So I can't say I miss it, because I just enjoy a peaceful mind. Drink, drugs and so forth, these things temporarily distract a person from their unhappiness, but in truth make them more unhappy. So there really isn't anything to miss. Like, for example, if you're going through some emotional problem and you have an unpeaceful mind, and then you turn to drink or drugs to try to manage that, even if you're able to distract yourself temporarily, it's not long before those unpleasant emotions come back again.
If you've just tuned in, This Mortal Coil, you're listening to This Mortal Coil, and our guest tonight is Gen Kelsang Dorning. He is a Buddhist monk with the Kadampa. Do we say the Kadampa order? I mean, is that what you... or you,
tradition.
Tradition. And Kadampa meditation centres can actually be found right around the country, all over the place, and actually in places that you wouldn't even expect from time to time. How much of your work now is about spreading that message of non-attachment, Dorning?
Yeah, so the centre that I first discovered this path to happiness was Kadampa Meditation Centre Sydney, and that's still there. That's in Surrey Hills. And we have Kadampa Meditation Centres in Melbourne CBD, in the Dandenong Ranges, over in Fremantle in Western Australia, and all up the East Coast, and also and across Tasmania. And I get the opportunity also to teach in the Northern Territory. So I travel to both Darwin and Alice Springs. And I should just mention, with respect to listeners in Queensland, we have just opened a state-of-the-art, incredibly beautiful and modern meditation space in the Brisbane city. The suburb's called Spring Hill. It shoulders the CBD. And one of my teachers is based there. So our national spiritual director, Gen Rabton, he's based there, and he's responsible for spreading, also responsible for spreading Buddhist teachings throughout Australia, New Zealand, Southeast Asia. So if you're in Queensland, I think get to Kadampa Meditation Centre Brisbane. It's an amazing place.
I'd love to ask you a little bit more about your Buddhism. And you've said that Buddhism is a unifying religion. What do you mean by that?
Well, you don't have to be Buddhist to benefit from Buddha's teachings. I always think, when I think of Buddha, that Buddha was like a really nice bloke.
So not a god, not somebody that's sitting up in a cloud. talking
yeah,
down.
Yeah, he's not on a cloud with a clipboard, basically adding up all your actions and dishing out suitable punishments and rewards. He's just this nice guy walking around Asia teaching people how to become happy. Like, he didn't come up with the word Buddha. I mean, this was Siddhartha, the crown prince who renounced his kingdom to find the meaning of his life. And it's not like he thought, right, I'm enlightened now, so I'm going to need a new name. I think we'll go for Buddha. And I'm going to start up a new club, which I'm going to call Buddhism. And if you join in my club, you can have a badge with Buddhist. These names, they all came a bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Like Buddha, for example, is a Sanskrit word meaning awakened one. So he became known as the awakened one. And that was where Buddha came from. And when his instructions were more formalized, that's when they were given the name. The tradition came together, Buddhism and so forth. And so I've always felt that his teachings were kind of like a buffet. You know, he laid out all of his teachings and he said, you know, if you can just take whatever works for you. You don't need to become Buddhist. You don't need to take it all on. So in the same way, if you go to a buffet, you might just like the little mini sausage rolls or the, you know, the little pieces of cheese, but you might not like other things like the curry puffs. And so it's the same. You take what works for you. Now, in the end, the only way to have a happy life is through a still mind, because mind is the medium through which you experience life. So it doesn't actually matter what religion you are, what sex you are, what sexuality you are, what your age, culture, background is. You can still only have an enjoyable life if the medium through which you experience life is under control. Otherwise, if the mind is not under control, there's this constant drone in the background of your life, a constant turbulence which is undermining your ability to enjoy yourself. So it doesn't really matter what religion you are. Everybody can benefit from having a peaceful mind. Therefore, and what we say is everybody is welcome.
Where does karma come into your tradition?
Well, that's a good question. So in a nutshell, the best way to describe karma is to think like this. Our experience of people and things is determined by the feelings that we have with respect to them. So if I have an unpleasant feeling with respect to a person, mm-hmm. I will perceive that person as unpleasant without choice. If I have a pleasant feeling in my mind with respect to a person, I will perceive them as nice and attractive without choice.
Mm-hmm.
The feelings that are determining my reality are arising within my mind from where? From the potential to feel that way. So in terms of being happy and so forth, and what stops us from being happy, we have to ask the question, well, how do you put potentials for pleasant feelings into your mind? And the Buddhist answer to that is that potentials are impressions that are left from the way we think and act. So somebody who has a habitually loving mind, kind mind, caring mind, will be collecting impressions in their heart that will ripen as pleasant feelings. So that later, and maybe in future lives, as these potentials begin to ripen, happiness will come without choice. And if we have a destructive mind or a negative mind, if we are habitually angry, we will collect on our mind stream impressions that give rise to unpleasant feelings. So someone who is habitually angry throughout their life will find it increasingly difficult to be happy as they age.
Mm. Mm.
And so, I mean, and even if you're not 100% sure you believe that, you've got nothing to lose by training in what potentially is the meaning of your life, really. Abandoning negative minds and accumulating positive, peaceful minds.
So that's interesting, and that's all very much in the now and in this life. And you touched a second there on, you know, lives to come. And one thing that religions right around the world do is everybody's got an idea of what happens to us once we give up the ghost in this life. What do Buddhists believe happens after death in this life?
Well, Buddhists believe that death and rebirth are like one dream transitioning into another dream. And this karmic or potential that I just described plays a very, very significant part in that transition. So at the moment, if we were to fall asleep with an unhappy or negative mind, then the sleep and the dreams will be fitful and maybe we have nightmares. Mm. In a similar way, as we're dying, if a negative potentiality ripens, the dreamlike next experience will be one of suffering. So the main goal of this life for a Buddhist, the minimum goal for this life for a Buddhist is to die with a peaceful mind. Because if we die with a peaceful mind, it will trigger one of the positive potentialities that was left on our mind. And therefore, the next dream, if you like, that arises in the mind stream or from the mind stream will be very pleasant and beautiful. So this describes how this explains how Buddhists steer away from this concept of an external force or power that's saying, okay, well, you've been good, you can go here, and you've been bad, and you can go here. Buddhists don't believe that at all. Buddhists believe, whereas other world religions talk of a creator, we talk about, or a creator of the world, Buddhists talk about the creator of our world, our own individual world. And that creator is our mind, in dependence upon which potentialities are ripening at any given time. So it gives us a lot of, it empowers us to master our own reality, both during this life and then at our death, and gives us the ability to eventually create our own beautiful next dreamlike life.
Dawning at this time of the evening/morning, that's actually a beautiful place to end. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you, Melanie. Thank you.
On ABC Radio, it's Nightlife.